It's a real pleasure for me to be here with you and to give sort of the first of the sort of introductory talks for this Alpha course, something I hope that you will greatly enjoy and be able to take full advantage of, and certainly something which is always open for you to bring friends to at any time. It's very interesting for me. I've been living back in this part of the world now, having spent most of my childhood in the Middle East for several decades. And I can remember when I first used to come back to the UK, sometimes we would go, we would always go to carol services at Christmas time. And I don't know if you've read any books by Ian Rankin. He's a very famous contemporary crime writer, actually one of the first crime writers to win major international literary prizes around the world, because if you're into English literature, you look rather snobbishly down your nose at people who write detective stories. And it was interesting, in his novels and in my experience, you'd go to a church and very often, many of those services, they'll be quite empty. And it's been interesting for me now, having lived now in this part of the world now for several decades, if you want to come to a carol service at Christmas time in this church, you have to be prepared to get here 45 minutes early, you have to queue outside, they do multiple services, try and get many people in, and you're still not guaranteed even be able to physically get into the building. So there is this interesting question about why is it that so many people seem to be increasingly asking questions, some of the very big questions that actually Alpha is designed to answer. And it's not just about hedging your bets. I can remember one of my aunts who was actually really quite a convinced atheist. She had her kids baptized in one church and dedicated in another, and she didn't even believe in God. And I can remember saying to her, "Why did you do that?" And she said, "Well, there might be something in it, so I thought I'd better cover all the bases. And then I thought, you know, if I picked the wrong religion, I didn't want to make God angry, so what I thought I'd do is I'd do all of them, you know, so at least at one point I would have made him happy somewhere." You know, it's like the story of the veterinarian who also did a training course in taxidermy, and then he hung a big sign outside his practice that said, "Either way, you'll get your dog back." And it's sort of like trying to cover, you know, both sides of the equation. You know, no matter what happens, at least there's something to say. But I actually think there's something more serious going on, which is driving that. And I'm not going to speak to all of this directly now. That would take too much time. But a couple of months ago, I was reading a newspaper editorial. And every so often, you read something in the newspaper and you think, actually, whoever wrote that, that seems to make some sense. And this is what he wrote. I won't read all of it. I'll just read part of it. He says, "What we're witnessing right now throughout the Western world is the politics of anger. There's anger at the spread of unemployment, leaving whole regions bereft of hope and work. There is anger at the failure of successive governments to control immigration and to integrate people who are arriving from outside. There's anger at financiers who brought the global economy to the brink of disaster and yet continue to reward themselves as if nothing had happened. There's anger at CEOs using public corporations for private benefit. There is anger that while a few have benefited disproportionately from the global economy, most people have seen their standards of living stay static or decline. There's anger at the perceived impotence of governments to control the spread of extremism and terror. And there's a widespread feeling that the world in the 21st century is running out of control. This has led to the resurgence of the far right and the far left. These are dangerous, the far right seeking a return to a golden age that never was, the far left in pursuit of a utopia that never will be. They both become enemies of freedom. Meanwhile, we have a rise of anti-political politicians who raise expectations that cannot be met, and when reality bites, anger becomes deeper and darker. The problems facing the West are real and serious, but there is something deeper behind all of this. For the past half a century, we've been living through one of the great unstated social experiments of all time. We've tried to construct a world without identity and without morality. Instead, we've left it to two systems to deal with the problems of our collective life, the market economy and the liberal democratic state. Morality has been outsourced to the market. The market gives us choices. And all morality, therefore, is reduced to a set of choices in which right or wrong have no meaning beyond the satisfaction or frustration of desire. We find it increasingly hard to understand why there might be things we want to do but should not do because they're dishonorable or disloyal or demeaning. In a word, unethical. Too many people in positions of public trust have come to the conclusion that if you can get away with it, you'll be a fool not to do it. And that is how elites betray public trust. And when that happens, trust collapses and a civilization begins to decay and die. Meanwhile, at the same time, we've abolished our sense of national identity. The effect is to turn our society from a home into a hotel. In a hotel, you pay the price, you get a room, and are free to do what you like, as long as you don't disturb the other guests. But a hotel is not a home. It doesn't generate identity, loyalty, or a sense of belonging. I remember reading that and thinking, isn't that interesting? All of us, to some extent, we're asking those questions about identity, and we're asking questions in terms of who am I, and we're also asking questions about morality. How should I live? Are there any kinds of rights or wrong? How do we actually live? And what is exhausting is that having been through a period of time where we told everybody it doesn't really matter what you believe, we're actually coming to the conclusion that maybe it does. And we're so exhausted through the effort of trying to create our own sense of identity, our own sense of what is right and wrong. It seems at times very disorientating, indeed confusing, to try and think, well, what if there are, what if any answers are out there? And one of the beautiful things about this Alpha course is it is designed to help you wrestle exactly with such questions, which is why we hope we may see you. Now, normally, most of the talks that you'll hear every evening are going to be much better than this. What we do is we give a very disappointing talk at the front because everything that comes after that is fantastic by comparison. But what I'd love to do with you is just share a little bit of my own story with this. As I said in the very beginning of my introduction, I spent most of my childhood living in the Middle East. We were in the United Arab Emirates. I lived in a place called Dubai. Many of you would have heard of that. When I moved to Dubai in 1976, there was one hotel there. I don't know if any of you have been to Dubai or seen pictures of Dubai, but there's more than one hotel now. And from there, in the early 80s, we moved to Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. And that's where then I went and spent the rest of my childhood. So I grew up as a child hearing nothing about the Christian faith. If you organized a meeting like this in Saudi Arabia, that would be a crime punishable by death. They remove your head with an axe. It's a very effective deterrent, no repeat offenders. And I grew up hearing nothing about the Christian gospel. As a matter of fact, I would say I probably wasn't particularly interested in God one way or another. I don't think I was an atheist. I wasn't against him. I wasn't for him. I wasn't anything. I think I was basically for me. I think I was just mainly interested in me, which is why I'm so disappointed to be living in such a narcissistic culture in this day and age, because people don't have enough time to think about me in the same way they used to. They're also busy thinking about themselves. So when my parents finally exited from that part of the world, I got to meet some Christians. And right from the get-go, I realized that I was looking at two very different types of people. I used to go occasionally from time to time to an Anglican church. There was a cathedral in the city in which I lived. And I used to go and sit in the back and get thoroughly bored. But I realized if I went about once a month, everybody thought I was very respectable. And I very quickly learned as a teenager, if everybody thinks you're respectable, you can get away with almost anything else. And so it actually served my purpose. But what I saw there didn't particularly excite me. However, there were some people in that church, and there were other people who described themselves as Christians, and there was definitely something different about their life. And it got me asking all kinds of questions. Now, I'd never deliberately asked those questions before, but as I began thinking about it, I realized I was basically wrestling with a series of questions. Who am I? A question of identity. Why am I here? A question of meaning and purpose. Where am I going? A question of destiny. Now, I wasn't disturbed, so I wasn't walking down the street on my way to go and buy milk thinking, who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? It was just occasionally from time to time, at those more quiet, reflective moments, I'd find myself asking those questions. And I think every person at some point asked those kinds of questions. Now, what I needed to do and what I tried to do was construct and build for myself a sense of identity and a sense of meaning and purpose. Now, as an older teenager in life, although I thought I was incredibly sophisticated, what that basically meant was everything I saw in movies that I thought would be good for me, that I'd adopt for myself. So I began to construct an identity for me. One of my heroes was a guy who amazingly, this actor, he's never won an Oscar, I don't know why, his name was Arnold Schwarzenegger. You may be familiar with his great body of work, or you may simply be familiar with his great body, but either way, I remember seeing him as a teenager thinking, I want to look like that. I actually exercised for a whole week once in order to develop some muscles, stood in front of the mirror, and there was no discernible impact whatsoever. But I wanted something of his image. I remember watching one of his movies, which started with him walking up a mountain, carrying a tree on his shoulder while smoking a large cigar. And since I don't have the build or the inclination to carry trees, the part of the image I could take for myself was that of cigar smoking. So I started smoking big cigars. They looked like little baseball bats. I thought that made me look cool. Another one of my heroes was James Bond. He was definitely cool. I read all the novels. I saw all the movies. James Bond had a silver cigarette case. I had a silver cigarette case. I had my initials engraved in the bottom right-hand corner because I thought that would make me look cool. That was what I was going for. As you can see, I never quite got there. But, you know, I was aspiring to be cool. I used to smoke filterless French cigarettes because you can remove a filterless cigarette from a cigarette case and you can flick it so it spins in the air. When you catch it with your mouth, it doesn't matter which end you've caught, you can always light the other end. Now, sadly, all of this is true. If my wife were here, she would tell you that it is true, but she wished it wasn't. You know that little bit on a box of matches you strike a match against in order to light it? Well, I used to remove that and I used to stick it to the bottom of my shoe. So having flicked a cigarette into my mouth, I could lean against a wall, take a match and light it on my shoe like I'd seen happen in the Western movies. And that was inspired for me by the person who I felt was the coolest person who'd ever lived, a man by the name of Clint Eastwood. Some of you all know of whom I speak. And as far as I was concerned, no one was cooler than Clint Eastwood. He was being interviewed once and the interviewer said to him, "Why does everybody think you're such a cool person?" And he took a little cigarillo, put it on the edge of the table so it was overhanging a bit, flicked it so it started spinning in the air. While it was spinning in the air, took a match from his back pocket, struck it under the table, caught the cigar, lit it, inhaled very deeply, blew a big smoke ring, three little smoke rings through the big smoke ring and said, "I don't know." And that's what I was going for. That's what I was looking to construct an image. And whether we're open about it or not, all of us in this room are living out an identity that we've either constructed or has been projected on us. We're all trying to become the people that we feel that we should be in order to be happy and fulfilled. And the question is all of that going in the right direction? What is the way that we should live in order to truly discover who we are? Well, one of the most interesting things that Jesus Christ said is, "I am the way." He says, if you really want to know, he says, come to me. He doesn't promise to teach us a way or simply show us a way. He promises to be the way, that somehow through him, in him, because of him, there is actually a way to know all of this. And that's what Alpha is designed to do. You saw me just now, really. I tend to sometimes take notes on my phone or I have an iPad. So let's suppose you see me with my new iPad mini, which I'm very proud of. My wife is hoping to get one for Christmas, but I believe it's all important we learn how to live with a sense of disappointment. So let's suppose you see me with my new iPad mini, and you come to me and you say, "Michael, are you having any success with that?" And I look at you and I say, "You know what? It's fantastic. I own a small coffee shop," because that's the trendy thing that all hipster guys do these days. "I have a small coffee shop, and do you know the iPad mini is the perfect size with which to serve two medium-sized cappuccinos, the most common order in my coffee shop? I bought all of my staff iPad minis, and from now on, we'll be serving all of our coffee off one of those." If that was my response to your question, "Are you having any success with that?" you would look at me and say, "Michael, I don't think you know what an iPad is for." Well, what are you for? What is it that actually infuses your life with meaning, purpose? What is it on a Monday morning when you get up that says, "Well, I know what this is all about"? Well, the Alpha course is designed to help you deal with and wrestle with and engage with some of those questions, which is why you'll all be invited around your tables to share what you think and to bring that to the table. Well, as I know, as I was building a sense of identity for myself and also trying to figure out exactly how I should be living, this group of Christians who I knew, I got to know them and I joined a small discussion group, and every week we'd meet together, very much like you're doing now. We'd have some food, there'll be a short talk, there'll be a long time of questions after it. I asked most of the questions. And I can remember after about 6 to 7 months, I was talking with one of the organizers of this, and I said, you seem to be a bit disappointed about something. And he said, "Yeah," he said, "you know, we were hoping that maybe we could just go away for a couple of days, take everyone with us. But in the country I was living in at the time, because we left the Middle East at that point, we were living in an island called Cyprus, where my mother is from, controlled very strongly by various different factions there. He said, "We can't get permission from the government." He says, "because we need permission to actually organize something like this legally." So I said, "That's not a problem. My family in that part of the world, I don't know how to phrase this nicely, we're connected to the government. For example, when we moved to Cyprus, having been out of the country for about 18 years, my mother rang the telephone company from a neighbor's phone to arrange the installation of a phone line into our home and was told she'd have to wait 6 months. At which point she burst into floods of tears, and one of my uncles was visiting and he said, "Why are you crying?" And she explained. The very next morning, the president of the National Telephone Authority personally came to our house to supervise the installation of a line, apologized for the fact that they couldn't arrange it last night, and hope he hadn't insulted the family in any way. So it was that kind of family. So I went home and I said, Mum, I said, that group I'm part of, we all want to go away together and the government won't let us. I said, do you know the chief of police? He was one of the people who had to approve this going away. And my mother said, yes, of course I know him. When I was 15 years old, he invited me to go out with him on a date. Your Uncle George knocked out his two front teeth and said if he ever spoke to me again, he would kill him. So I said, well, do you think you could ring him and ask him for a favor? Because we need to be able to go away. And he's one of the two people who needs to sign the piece of paper. So my mother rang him. He immediately, of course, remembered who she was. I guess you wouldn't if you're still missing your two front teeth. And he said, look, he says, I'd love to see you again. And I didn't know it was your son. If that was him, of course, we never would have said, no, please go. She hung up the phone. She said, okay, that's no problem. Who else do you need? I said, well, do you know the Minister of Interior? And within half an hour later, the Minister for Interior was ringing from his holiday, again, to apologize for the fact there'd been some delay with the paperwork, which he couldn't explain. Of course, there'd be no problem. So I arranged this camp, and I went up a day early to set it up. All of my friends came on that camp, and during that camp, I actually became a Christian, which goes to prove one thing, which is that God does have a sense of humor, because he had me plan and arrange and organize my own conversion to the Christian faith. What happened while during that time was I came to a very disturbing conclusion. I'd been looking at the Christian faith for a while. I'd been asking all my difficult questions. I found that Christians were actually very happy for me to ask all my difficult questions. And I'd come to the conclusion that it was true. Except I felt it didn't bother me. Does that make sense? Okay, yeah, so maybe it's true. You know, Jesus is God and, you know, we'd looked at something called the resurrection. Was Jesus Christ a historical figure? Did he actually live? Was he actually crucified and all this kind of buried and raised to life? And I thought, actually, you know what? You can make a pretty strong case for the resurrection. One of the most famous Jewish professors of history here at this university, very famously at one point, came out and said, you know, you can make a very powerful case for this resurrection. And I thought, so, but if it happened, so what? I mean, okay, yeah, something amazing happened a few thousand years ago. Let's move on. It's an awful lot later now. 2,000 years have passed. And when I was away at this camp, I can remember thinking, wait a minute, this is actually true. And if it's true, it should actually change my life. Because what they're telling me is they don't want me to believe in God. They're saying that God actually wants to have a relationship with me and I should somehow be living how he wants me to live. And I realized at that point, for the first time in my life, that I didn't want the Christian faith to be true. So I was very happy to look into is it true or false when I felt it didn't mean anything, but at some point I thought, gosh, actually, I think it does mean something, and I didn't want it to be true. The reason I didn't want the Christian faith to be true is actually I was quite happy. I was doing very well, and my life was going very, very well. I came from a great family. I'd had an amazing opportunity to travel, education, everything was going well. I was very, very sporty back then, all the way during high school. I'd been captain of the swimming team, captain of the tennis team, captain of the chess team, captain of the debate team. You know, I was a straight A student. Sporty, remarkably handsome, as you can see, and incredibly humble for a teenager as well. And, you know, I if you were to ask me, I mean, no one, I didn't do this, but I think if you came to me and said, hey, Michael, give yourself, out of 10, how well do you think life is going right now? I would have said, I don't know, 8 or 9. I was just very happy. And I can remember thinking, if I become a Christian, life is going to get worse. It felt like if the Christian faith was true and I became a Christian, I felt like it would be dropping like from 8 out of 10 to 2 out of 10. It felt like this massive existential downgrade in life. I mean, this was during the 80s. I used to feel then about Christians in the same way I used to feel about communists. They have nothing, but they want to share it with me. And I was just, it wasn't skepticism about truth anymore. I was personally skeptical. Would this actually mess up my life? Now, I think we're all wired in different ways. I think it's true to say that some of us are led by the heart and then we figure it out afterwards. Other of us want to figure it out and then we actually give ourselves to it. And there are all kinds of different people, all kinds of different paths. I was very much, I need to know if this is true or not. And having looked into it and asked all of my questions, I thought, you know what, I'm convinced this is true. And when we were away for these couple of days, I can remember thinking, I really think I should become a Christian, but I don't want to. Because I'd organized this thing, a lot of my friends were there, and I actually went and found about 8 or 9 of my friends. I gathered them all together, and I said, guys, I have to tell you something. I'm actually going to become a Christian tonight. I'm going to ask these guys to pray for me, and I'm telling you now, because from now on, I won't be enjoying myself anymore. That's exactly how I felt. I felt like I was sacrificing on the altar of truth my only chance for satisfaction in life. So the next huge surprise for me was to find that actually when I became a Christian, far from my life becoming empty, it suddenly seemed to become full. And this is another very famous thing that Jesus Christ said. He said, I am the life, in me is life, and I've come that you may have life to its full abundance. Rather than entering into something which I thought would actually take me down, I actually went the other way. I can remember just after I became a Christian, a little bit later, more or less the next day, I was talking to this lady who was a model, and she was one of the reasons I didn't want to become a Christian. So I'm trying to put it like that. And I had unsuccessfully been trying to engage her in things that I thought might be fun for us to do for a while. And I can remember meeting her, having just become a Christian. And as I walked into the room where she was sat, she looked at me and she said, something's happened to you. You're different. What happened? And I remember saying, I'm not sure I can explain it to you. She said, well, try. I said, well, I became a Christian yesterday. And she looked at me and leant forward and she said, would you like to sleep with me? And I remember looking at her saying, if you'd asked me 48 hours ago, the answer would have been yes. I said, but today, the answer's no. And the strange thing for me was I wasn't at all disappointed by my answer. I'd found something else in life which was bigger and greater and grander than anything else I'd ever encountered. What is it that we are here for? Well, Christ offers us that abundant of life. I remember after all of this thinking, before I started asking myself all of these questions, I was wrestling with these questions about identity, meaning, purpose. And I very quickly began to discover that actually it wasn't the fact that I now had knowledge necessary of all of these answers in detail, but I'd finally come into relationship with someone who did. And that's the most incredible thing, which is right at the heart of the Christian faith. It's not simply something which says, hey, this is true and you can investigate it with your mind, although that is correct. It's not just something that says, well, look, this is how we should live, and you can look at that pattern of life, you can look at it, but it's more than that. And it's even more than just somehow finding some kind of fulfillment. What had actually happened in and through it was I had found both a sense of belonging, this is why I'm here, this is my home, and also an answer to that question of identity. This is really who I am. And it had been answered, actually, because I'd been put in contact with someone who actually knew the answers. And that is really the most outstanding claim of the Christian faith. As you go through the Alpha Course, and I hope you'll go through even if this talk hasn't fully engaged with you, it's one thing to go around saying, look, I know everything, that's crazy. And Christians can't possibly do that. It's another thing to say, look, I've experienced everything and I'm telling you what's the best way. You can't say that either, that's also crazy. The question is there someone who actually knows who you are, knows why you're here, and has enough interest to want relationship with you and to give you the time and to tell you and reveal that to you? If Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and if he has revealed and made himself known here, and you can have relationship with him, in him and through him and because of him, it is actually possible to find these things. And that's what the Alpha Course actually does. So you'll find this little booklet here, and you're invited to take it away and keep it. It's yours to keep and read. There will be a whole series of talks. There'll be discussions around the table. You may enjoy somehow just reading this. Sometimes the talks will be a bit different to what's in here, in which case you can get things twice. You'll find that it's also possible at times, this book will sometimes talk about things that Jesus said. If you want to read things that Jesus said, you'll also find a Bible. There are actually Bibles here in this church. If you don't have a Bible, feel free to take one. It's the only thing you can steal from a church without getting into trouble. Take one home with you. It's yours. You may be thinking how a church like this is able to give away all this free food and also even give away expensive books like Bibles. If you're a church member here, you need to think about increasing your giving, because I'm very generous with other people's money. Our invitation to you is to take the time over these 10 weeks to find out, is this really true? Is it actually real? Who did Jesus claim to be? What has that got to do with me? and how does it help me answer those questions? I really hope that you will enjoy that time. Well, you've been very, very gracious listening to me. I really hope you enjoy the rest of your evening. Tim is going to come back up here and give you some further instructions. But let me just say, as I wrap up our time here together, and I can say this without any, even the slightest hint of exaggeration whatsoever, that out of every group of people I have ever spoken to anywhere in the world, you are all by far the most recent. Thank you very much.